this is recording three for when I get lost and start it. It often helps if I say that. So Spinoza he's an interesting philosopher, because in some strange sort of circle of what we might call objectivist philosophy, Spinoza's time has come round again, because there's been in 20th century philosophy, there was a tremendous effort spent in trying to make objectivism into a kind of a materialistic understanding of everything in the universe that made sense, trying to make it coherent. And the most famous people involved in that would be Daniel Dennett and Richard Dawkins. You know, the famous atheists. They in the 20th century, they were an attempt to make a pure materialism coherent, intellectually coherent. And in a way, the philosophical community has accepted that that doesn't work, because you can't explain consciousness if you're entirely materialistic. And then there has been an attempt to make dualism work, which has failed, because you can't give an explanation about how this immaterial experience that we're having can have any effect on the material. And what's left is monism, which is to say, well, there's really only one substance here. It's not material. It's not the human subjectivity. It's God. Only we don't call it God anymore. We call it panpsychism. So it's becoming just recently, it's 21st century kind of breaking waves in philosophy of mind. This idea of panpsychism is that all of matter, right down to the atomic and subatomic level, in some way or other is incipiently conscious. So that you don't have a dualism that says there's consciousness over there and matter over there. You don't say it's all matter. You don't say it's all consciousness. You say, no, matter is suffused with a kind of a potential consciousness at the level where even an atom might be having a kind of an experience. And that actually was first worked out in 1600 and X by Spinoza, who said, The only way we can make anything, any sense, any intellectual coherence out of all of this is to say that there is only really one substance that unifies everything. And within that, there's the appearance of matter and the appearance of experience, but really it's all the one substance, and that substance is God. And not only that, he attempted to prove it by setting out all of the axioms, you know, the first principles, on which he would say, I take this to be absolutely true, and then he deduced all the rest of his philosophy from those axioms in the same style as Euclid did in geometry. So if you pick up Spinoza's Ethics, you'll see that there are all these axioms and corollaries and deductions, and they're all numbered. And he deduces his whole philosophical system from the top down, so to speak. It's a brilliant piece of work, and there's behind the axiomization and the appearance that it's all reason and geometry and deduction, there's a kind of a view of what is that is quite compelling. He's quite an interesting philosopher. So he was the first to try and make sense of all of this, and he could only make sense of it by saying all is God. But you could say, you can take God out of it. If you take God out of it, you get panpsychism. You could say, well, all of matter in somehow is conscious. And if you put it together in the right way, you get something like my consciousness. If you put it together in another way, you get worm consciousness. If you put it together in another way, you actually get some kind of experience of being a rock. Of course, how that works, how do all the atoms coalesce to produce an experience of being a human being? Nobody has an answer to that. But the idea of panpsychism gets rid of a lot of incomprehensibilities that exist as a result of trying to think that everything's material, and then you've got a kind of a psychic experience that is separate from that. Because do you see, your actual experience now is immaterial, in the sense that if you think there's a material world, where is your consciousness, your experience now of this room? Where is it? I mean, I think people would naively say, it's in my head. Mm. Okay, well, where exactly? In what way is it in your head? What you're having is an experience that's very visually centered. So it appears like you're looking out of a head, right? But that head that you're looking out of, that's all appearing in this field of experience, isn't it? If this field of experience is presenting all of these things to you, but do you see the presentation of you sitting over there? My experience of you is not over there in your body. It's a result of something going on in my brain, all right? So you're not. My experience of you is not over there. My experience of the being and over there is somehow being produced within experience. You see that? It's not that there's a physical universe here and your experience is somehow laid on top of it. It doesn't. There's no place anywhere in the whole of this, if there were a physical universe, your experience of it doesn't show up anywhere. It's in a totally different dimension. It's in a dimension of colour, sound, you know, the qualities of the experience just ain't there. They ain't there. They're not there. They're not in a head. They're not in a knee. They're not in the heart. They're not anywhere. Do you see? Do you grasp that intuitively?
To a point.
But it's not even to a point. It's not. It's a kind of a logical consequence of, if you think what the physical is, and you think it's just matter laid out in space, and that matter has no consciousness whatsoever in it, which is what Galileo proposed. It's a consequence of thinking that way. It doesn't mean it's true, because it's all going on in the minds of the people who are developing the science. But if you accept that, then your being conscious doesn't connect with the physical world. It's in another dimension. And then you end up with the problem of dualism, which is, well then, how can what's going on in the physical world affects your consciousness at all? If your consciousness isn't physical, you know, one thing bumping into another can't bump into consciousness, can it? I just want you to feel the problem of dualism. There has to be some magical effect that says, when certain stuff happens in my brain, I see something. You can't say that the cause and effect of what's going on in your neurons is causing a colour experience. There's no colour experience in the brain. So what is causing it? There's no physical explanation, because we've defined the physical to be physical. So the physical can't affect consciousness. So how could consciousness know anything about the physical? And Locke, of course, is saying, yes, it does. It's a tabula rasa. And what's in the physical imprints itself on the tabula rasa. Okay. Where's the tabula rasa? And how does what's physical have any effect on the tabula rasa? this dualism collapses with this problem. Spinoza and Leibniz basically call in God. God's, they say, well, yeah, and this is what you do when you're in trouble as a philosopher. You phone up God and you say, God, would you mind taking care of that? And God says, no problem. Well, so basically the thinking is, God arranges it. Right? It's a divine action. There's a divine parallelism going on. God so arranges it that whatever's happening in the physical sphere, there's a corresponding experience in you, and not in your body, right? Because your body is appearing, right? It's in the physical sphere. There's a corresponding thing happening in you that magically, because God so arranges it, expresses exactly what's happening in the physical. And you see, for Descartes and that time, it was quite acceptable to call on God, because nobody doubted God was there and nobody doubted God could do anything. But for us, you know, 20th century humanity, at a certain point we stopped thinking that there was a God, thanks to the theory of evolution and maybe a little help from the First World War. The idea that there was some benevolent God who cared about us, that put us all in the trenches, you know, didn't, we were having trouble squaring that. Take God away, then that the parallelism between what's happening in physically and what's happening in the psyche becomes a totally inexplicable mystery. Hence, panpsychism comes over and says, there must be some kind of consciousness in matter. And then suddenly everyone says, well, that's what Spinoza said. Well, you know, it's already been thought of. What it really is a sign of, if I want to be relevant to this course, is that contemporary philosophy of mind still hasn't caught up with Husserl. And they ain't there yet. They're kind of still cycling through ideas from the 16th century, I would say. You know, materialism fails, dualism failed, or we go back to monism, which is all of the ideas were already in place. It's got, all that's happened is that these positions are updated by the, of course, we know so much more because of our science. Once Spinoza in a nutshell, God is not he who is, but that which is. In other words, it's all God being God. All of it. God being God. If it's all God being God, there's no problem. There's only one substance here, and that substance is God. And if God wants, if we want, God's substance can become experience, or God's substance can become stuff. God's substance can become anything. And if there's stuff and experience, it's all okay, right? Because it's all God's substance, and God's substance can communicate with God's substance. And in a strange way, quantum mechanics is upholding that. You know, there's a sense, there's in quantum mechanics they discover effects where what's happening in one part of the universe is instantaneously communicated to another, which means, in a sense, it's all one substance. There isn't a kind of a void with empty space where you have to pass messages across the empty space. In some sense or other, all of space is interconnected. And if that's so, it's interconnected with what? Well, if we go back to Spinoza, it's God's substance. He'd already solved it, really. John, you want to say something?
Well, I don't know Benedict Spinoza. I just wondered if he's just bringing this in as a theory to fill in all the gaps, kind of thing, or whether he's experiencing that.
It's hard. It's
what did he say?
It's hard to say, but my sense from reading Spinoza is that he was in touch with something, but he expressed it in in the style of the day. It's very hard to read through what someone's written to know exactly where they are, but there was the sense that Spinoza felt that he was in God, and he didn't mean God as the church meant it, because his philosophy was a heresy in that way. So he wasn't proposing this because he was trying to fit in with the church, if you like. There's a certain sense with Descartes that he was worried about the
fitting it in as a kind of a,
but he's also trying to fit
as an excuse.
He wants to fit it all together with his reason as well. But I think he was inspired. But you'll find Spinoza very hard to read. So I'm basing this on little bits of Spinoza. I've never made it through the Ethics all the way. So back to, so Spinoza is an attempt for human reason to encompass everything in one unified system. And this, you could read that as omniscience, but it's really omniscience. It's a property that is usually ascribed to God, where God sees everything as it is. But there's a kind of a dream of omniscience in this new science that develops. That human intelligence is that we are, in a way, as above, so below. That human reason is a kind of finite reflection of God's reason. And God can know everything, and human reason can know everything. The only thing is, God knows everything all at once now, and human reason has to inch away at it in this kind of eternal progression of science, where we learn a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. But behind it all, there's this absolute faith that the entire universe is rationally knowable, and that it is built on basic principles of reason, which isn't here, that Leibniz expressed as the principle of sufficient reason, which meant this was the faith of the age, that nothing is without reason. That everything that is by virtue of there being some reason for it. And the ultimate reason is God. You know, that's where all reason finally, if you like, grounds. Yeah, it all grounds out in the. And just like I was saying, the ultimate reason being God is, if you can't find a reason for something, you say it's God. So you've got a system that says, but we can understand God's creation because God is reason. So God will have had a reason for everything, and finally we're going to be able to piece it together. Because God made us in His own image. Do you see? It's theological and rational at the same time, and it's not nothing. It's not a crazy idea that just five or six people had. This was the foundation of our modern culture. It came out of this tremendous faith that we could come to know everything. And we set out on this path, and we haven't come to know everything. It's gone wrong. We can't exactly say it's failed. If we follow what's happened, the way that it's failed is for good reason too. There's even reasons for why it failed. One of the reasons that Husserl is going to say is that it failed is because we were naive in our understanding of subjectivity.
When he says spiritual, what does he mean by it? Sometimes I try to understand it by understanding other German philosophers or Romanticism when they say spiritual.
Oh no, the problem here is that when the Germans speak of mind, they use the word Geist, which is also means spirit. Yeah. I wish Greta was here now, because she'd be able to tell us more about the Germans. So the Germans, mind and spirit for them are co-concepts, whereas for us, when we say spirit, we imagine something distinct from the mind.
So when he's saying spiritual, I should understand mental.
Yes. So when he says the spiritual acquisitions of culture, he means things like art, and we wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't trade, we wouldn't necessarily say that. But even government, even Parliament, I think would come under his heading of a spiritual acquisition, because it's entirely come out of our minds, rather than things that we've built.
Yeah, because if someone who doesn't know this could very easily interpret it spiritual as in India as
yes,
yeah.
So because today you see spiritual a lot in Buddhist kind of
yeah.
stuff, so you might think that it means that, but it's not.
No, the whole concept of spirit is mixed up with one's essential being, which is in question anyway.
Mm.
Yes, and certainly for Husserl, it's in question. What that is. So he, in a way, transcendental subjectivity, for him, is more than just what we would mean by mind. But it's not spirit either.
Yeah.
It's a third thing.
Yeah.
Which we don't have a word for, so we'll call it transcendental subjectivity.
I think
for now.
Germans see something when they talk about it.
Yes.
German people, German culture. I try to understand sometimes, but sometimes they talk also about the spirit of the nation and stuff
yes,
like that.
Yes, yeah, and we have to be very nervous when that happens.
Yes.
Well, we have to be nervous when any nationality starts speaking
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of interesting thing in German culture, when they say spiritual, spirit, and
so. So, do we get something of the sense from this lecture about God being the infinitely distant man, in the same way as we start off with material triangles, and we end up with a totally idealized triangle?
So who is this?
This is still Husserl.
Oh, this is Husserl.
We're back to Husserl now. There's an analogy here between the triangle that I'm drawing and the perfect idealized triangle that's behind it. That is for mathematics, that is the true triangle. And in a way, we're kind of an imperfect presentation of what reason is and of what God is. And as we perfect our reason, we perfect our understanding, and we perfect our human civilization, we're approaching to this ideal point that is what God is, or what God had in mind. I'm just trying to get the sense of this, of the spirit of that still operates in science. You know, when people are looking for the theory of everything, they're still in their way looking for that that mathematical description that was in God's mind. Though there isn't that, they don't use the word God anymore. But that there is such an idea that in a way, if we express it perfectly, we have the very idea that generated the entire universe, and we can reconstruct everything that happened in the universe from out of that idea by sheer deduction. Do you know that that's what the theory of everything is supposed to be? You know, the Big Bang, and then we have a completed physics says, and then purely on the basis of the mathematics of the properties of the Big Bang, we can deduce the entire universe. And not only that, we're already deducing whether it ends or not. Do you know, it's an entire act of deduction. Amazing, isn't it? And so that's, so we're still, do you see, cosmology is the omniscience of science, attempting to, in a way, say this is, we don't say it's God's mind anymore, because we don't think there's a God, but we're still engaged in the same game. And then we've got Berkeley and Hume. I'd like to get through Berkeley and Hume at least. So I'm not a scholar of Berkeley and Hume, although I read them many years ago. I realise now, when I read back, how little I understood them at the time. But I'm going to give you a kind of, it's a sort of a children's version, yes, of Berkeley and Hume. Berkeley came along after Locke, and his basic move was to say, well, Locke says that our experience is, that's all right, our experience is of material things that we can't know in themselves, but they are the real cause of our experience. But we, although we have no access whatsoever to what they are in themselves, and Berkeley came along and made the obvious next step. He said, well, what if they ain't there? What if there are no material things at all? What difference would it make? What if all there is this dimension of sensory experience? If we took the material stuff away, and it, you know, the problem with dualism is it could have no effect on our experience anyway, unless God is doing some kind of jiggery pokery. If we took all the material stuff away, it wouldn't make any difference. And there's a thing called Occam's Razor, right? Barclay's being very scientific here. Occam's Razor says we should only propose things in our scientific theory as they're needed. Yes, as they provide some kind of explanatory leverage. And we've ended up now with Descartes' dualism, where the only thing we know for certain that exists, and we know for certain because we're experiencing it now, is experience. So it's not as if we can doubt that we're conscious. Berkeley just came along and said, well, if we take the entire material universe that we think we're having experience of, we just say it's not there, what difference would it make? You can feel like he was in somewhere, he's having a moment of enlightenment. He's saying, none at all. Do you see, our whole idea of the physical universe has been, we've reasoned it into existence. You know, on the basis of our experience, we've reasoned that there must be such a thing. But of course, it's achieving nothing. The fascinating thing about materialism is it reasons back for the other direction. It says, there's the material universe, what reason could there be for consciousness? None whatsoever. And there are actual materialists, and Daniel Dennett's one of them, who's reasoned that our idea that we're conscious must be some kind of illusion. How he can actually think that, it's unthinkable to anyone who has any kind of immediate knowledge of what it is to be conscious, but that position does exist. Berkeley's position is at least makes sense. So it was esse is percepi was his Latin phrase for it. The essence of being, of the being of anything, is for it to be perceived. That's the being of this computer is the being of its being seen. Yes. Of course, the problem with that, and Berkeley thought of this, is it should then be an entirely private thing. Yes, if that's the case, the thing is we're each having an entirely private experience, and yet it turns out that we seem to be agreeing. Now, either you end up in a solipsism that says actually only I'm conscious. Yeah, and it looks like you're all conscious. I mean, I don't know if you've ever had that. It happened to me in the Black Horse in Lewes. You know, when I should have been at school, I was down the pub one day, and it suddenly dawned on me. So, all I'm experiencing is this field of consciousness, right? That's all that's really actually here. And I never experience anyone else's, right? You're all having, you know, I think of it as a bubble. Right, you're all having a little bubble time on your own.
You've been active since school days.
The Black Horse is still there. I mean, one day there'll be a blue plaque, you know. Descartes was here, you know. Anyway, then it dawned on me, I've no idea whether any of you lot are having one of these bubbles. You say you are, But are you? How could I ever know that? But Berkeley doesn't go that far. I mean, there's a certain level. I think the for me, I mean, I've looked into this. I've looked into solipsism, and I say that, well, the only thing that saves us here is love. If you have any kind of idea that there's when you know love, you there's a knowledge in it. It's not a rational knowledge. It's not an empirical knowledge. But if you in love, there's another kind of knowledge. And if you just love one other person, I would suggest to you that there's the knowledge in that love that that other being is a being, just as you are. But apart from that, if you're a purely rational philosopher, then this form of reasoning is very compelling. There's kind of no escape from it. Berkeley didn't say that. He said, "Ah, well, guess who? Guess who's coordinating it all?" He was a bishop, by the way. There's a clue in that. Guess who's making sure that when I'm not looking at something, and then I look back, who's keeping it in mind, so to speak? You know, because even if everyone else is, and the fact is, I look away. You know, what's keeping that going? If it just exists as far as it's perceived, it's all in God's mind. Somewhere, he says, in God, we live and breathe and have our being. So another quite beautiful phrase, really. But Berkeley was, I think, also felt this, that really our being is a being in God's mind. And it's a being, it's an entirely sensory being of consciousness. And that's all there is. There's just our consciousness in the mind of God. And God keeps all of the ideas in mind for us.
So that's interesting. So like the center of solipsism is God's solipsism.
Yeah, exactly. God got lonely. So he decided to create the illusion of separate consciousness in all of us, so that God could come to get to know God. Because if there wasn't anything like that, if God couldn't in some way become separate from God, God could never know God. I mean, he's gone a very long-winded way about it. it's been a very torturous way.
He's playing some. He started looking at himself,
yes,
and he started looking at himself,
he got
split.
Yes, but you see, there's a sort of necessity in it. The only way that you see that the kind of there's an extraordinary thing in experience itself, what it is, why have we become separated? Well, how if you weren't, if there was no separation here, if God was just, if there were all of being were just unified all at once, and there was no distinction or separation, there was just being, being, being. That is being, being, being. There'd just be nothing. Is it? You see that? So that you can kind of see there's almost a logical necessity in the being pulled apartness to produce experience. Now this is very Berkeleyan. And then Hume goes, you know, because Hume starts that we're starting to see that with these philosophers. The whole idea of science and rationality is starting to disintegrate, that there's some kind of mathematical ideal reality behind things. Hume is famous for destroying the kind of foundations of induction, which I think the last 15 minutes we just make sure that everybody knows about induction. So somebody in the last class said that it was Maria actually. That she did a course where somebody went on about induction and she didn't understand what it was at the end of things. So there's deduction and induction, right? The two forms of inference, logical inference. Deduction, we start with first principles and things follow with absolute logical necessity on the basis of those principles. And the classic example is all men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Deduction Socrates is mortal. Because all men are mortal, Socrates is a man. From those two facts, we can deduce with utter certainty that Socrates is mortal. It may not. It may be false that all men are mortal. Maybe some are immortal. It may be false that Socrates is a man. But as soon as we accept that those two things are in fact true, then it follows with absolute necessity that Socrates is mortal. That's deduction. Whereas induction, which is the way that science proceeds, which is to science's great embarrassment ever since Hume, it starts along the lines of, okay, we're going to observe how things are, how things work here on the planet, and we're going to generalize, which is to go back in the other direction, and we're going to try and learn the form of things from the examples that they show us in experience. And that's a process of induction. I mean, the example I think Hume used was we observe lots and lots of swans. And over a period of time, we develop the idea, we generalise, we induce the idea of what it is to be a swan. And we that idea that we've induced has all the properties that are universal to all swans. The reason Hume used this is because at the time, in the medieval times, nobody had gone to Australia and discovered black swans. So they'd induced the idea that all swans are white, but all swans aren't white. You know? So the trouble with induction is that facts can turn up later to show you that your induction is false. But Hume wasn't attacking the idea of swans, he was attacking the very notion of cause and effect, which is something like, if I were to push that cup with my finger, there's an absolutely necessary law that means it will move. It did. Yeah. And if I was to do it again, it will move. It did. Now, science thinks if we can make repeated observations like that, we can induce mathematical laws with absolute certainty, because the mathematicians and the scientists think that they've discovered something called force.
Force.
F-O-R-C-E. And this comes down to the weak nuclear force and the strong nuclear force, whatever physics says it is at a certain level. And science thinks, especially before Hume, that we've been able to induce the reality of the existence of these forces by repeated observations of their functioning. And Hume says, no, it's just like the black swan. What you've observed is that over and over and over, when you hit something, it moves. Hit something, it moves. There's no absolute necessity that dictates, like a form of deduction, that one day your finger won't go through that cup. And in fact, the bizarre thing is, according to quantum mechanics, there's an absolutely not infinitesimal, a calculable possibility that it will, your finger will go through that cup. An awful lot of things have to line up at once, trillions and trillions of things, but it's possible that your finger could pass through that that cup. What Hume, because he's being psychological again, he's taking Locke and he's saying what we think that we've induced from hundreds and hundreds of observations of dropping things and measuring how they fall as absolute laws that operate with absolute necessity, which is what we think science is, this ideal of perfect rational knowledge of the universe, is just a kind of a form of habit. It's happening all psychologically. What we get is a feeling in us that if something happens over and over and over the same, then there must be something, some kind of necessity behind it. But all, there isn't any necessity behind it. There isn't anything more than you've observed the same thing happening over and over and over. He calls it just a constant conjunction. If you put these two things together and the third thing happens. The fact that it's happened twice, or 100 times, or 1,000 times, or 1,000,000 times, doesn't produce proof. It only has to not happen once, and the whole thing's finished. And this keeps on happening in science anyway. Do you know, it felt like Newtonian science was being confirmed and confirmed and confirmed by the orbits of the planets, until finally there was a little, I think, problem with the orbit of Mercury that had to be explained by relativistic effects. So there are things on the fringes of science that aren't explained by Newton that relativity had to come along and replace. So that, in a way, people didn't catch up with Hume until relativity destroyed Newton's view. Because until then, everyone thought, no, that's all very well, but it can't be true. Because, Newtonian physics is absolutely incontrovertibly true. Every observation we've made confirms it. Gravity operates by the inverse square law, and that's what determines everything that happens in the universe.
Can we go the other way then? Can we say there will always be a black swan?
Well, no, that's the terrible thing. You see, what Hume has come to say is that it may well be that we stumble across the perfect theory, but we'll never know.
Mm.
We'll never know that there isn't going to be a black swan one day. And even if we've gone 100 million trillion years, we still don't know that there isn't going to be a black swan. You know, there's no way that more and more and more observations that confirm what you think ever proves it. And so Hume basically says induction is not anything certain. Yes? It's just, you've just formed a very strong association in your mind between two classes of events. And you call it cause and effect. And you think there's some absolute necessity in it, and that there's something out there in the real universe that's causing it. But you have no evidence whatsoever to think that, because all you have evidence of is the evidence of your immediate sensory experience. So I'm elaborating this because Husserl's saying that pretty soon this mathematical science fell into difficulties. Do you see the difficulties that it's fallen into?
So going back to that, the first triangle was induction, when they were measuring.
Yes.
It was inductive proof, but it wasn't a proof, sorry.
Yeah.
But they tried to prove it through induction.
Yes, then, by measuring lots and lots of triangles.
Yeah. Then the second one is deduction.
Yes.
But that's on an idealised triangle.
Yeah,
so
in idealised mathematical space.
You can...
Yes.
Yeah.
And all deduction occurs in idealized space.
Mm.
Yes? You can't deduce, you can only deduce from ideas.
Yes.
You can, the thing about experience, though, is you can have a different kind of knowledge of experience. Science is all about induction and deduction. It's trying to go lead from one thing to the other. Yes? But there are things that you can know that aren't that kind of knowledge. Like you can know what colour is. Yeah, that's not a deduction. You don't deduce what colour is. You simply see what colour is. So there's another form of knowledge. But science isn't actually interested in that kind of knowledge. That's the knowledge of direct or immediate experience, which is phenomenological knowledge, which, you know, I wish we had time. All right, a little bit of George, and we'll have a little bit of David Hume, and I'm going to have to give up, aren't I? So we'll read out Berkeley. It is indeed an opinion strangely prevailing amongst men that houses, mountains, rivers, and in a word, all sensible objects have an existence, natural or real, distinct from their being perceived by the understanding. But with how great an assurance and acquiescence soever this principle may be entertained in the world, yet whoever shall find it in his heart to call it in question may, I feel like we're going back in time, if I mistake not, we're not in any kind of hurry here, perceive it to involve a manifest contradiction. For what are the forementioned objects but the things we perceive by sense? And what do we perceive besides our own ideas or sensations? And is it not plainly repugnant that any one of these or any combination of them should exist unperceived? He's simply saying all you ever know of the world is what you perceive. And what you perceive in vision are coloured things. So what are the things that we perceive? What are the and what we perceive, he's just saying one step further, is what is. So don't tell me, says Berkeley, that objects aren't coloured. Are you asleep? Are you having a bad dream? Because that's what Galileo is saying, in a sense. He's saying, well, where are these objects without colour? I can't see them. You see, there's a kind of a crazy common sense here. And let's go to David Hume, looking at his, suppose two objects to be presented to us, of which the one is the cause and the other the effect. 'Tis plain that from the simple consideration of one or both these objects, we shall never perceive a tie by which they are united, or be able certainly to pronounce that there is a connection betwixt them. 'Tis not, therefore, from any one instance that we arrive at the idea of cause and effect, or of a necessary connection of power, of force, of energy, of efficacy. Did we never see but particular conjunctions of objects, entirely different from each other, we should never be able to form any such ideas. So what he's saying is if nothing ever repeated itself in our experience, we'd never get an idea of cause and effect. Therefore, our entire idea of cause and effect comes out of the fact that things repeat themselves, and no more. I hope you're getting to see it's very hard to argue with this stuff.
And scientists, they are biased when they determine a cause to be a cause.
Well, I've got to say that since I did an advanced course in cause and effect at the University of Queensland, the scientists who are philosophically educated have cleaned up their language, and they don't even talk about cause and effect now. Thanks to what they talk about are regularities. They're on safer ground. They say, well, there are regularities. And we're not saying that they're in experience or in some material world, but what we are saying is that these regularities have a mathematical form. But it's almost thanks to Hume that scientists now use the word regularity and not cause and effect. Mm-hmm. But we don't. We still think.
Still stuck in the cause.
Well, not stuck. You know, you stamp on my foot, you caused it. Didn't you? Yeah, and your foot is the cause of the pain that I feel. Do you know? Do you see? I mean, I'm bringing you back to phenomenology, right? We certainly have an idea of cause and effect here that isn't to do with something happening in some mathematical world. Do you know? I guess the idea of cause and effect that we have comes out of our own decision to do stuff. We feel ourselves to be causes. And then we, in a way, we project that sense, that sense of agency that we have, we project that onto the things around us. But the real foundation of it, and we're doing phenomenology just in the last 2 minutes, the real phenomenological foundation of it is our own feeling of having something like a will that is efficacious, that I will now open my hand. And I was the cause of that, right? So we do have a ground of cause and effect. But we say, you know, gravity was the cause of that. Now, I agree with Hume there. Actually, and it turns out that gravity isn't the cause of that. Our latest science thinks that there's some kind of curvature in space-time. That means that it's like we're travelling in a lift at the moment. If we were travelling in a lift and it was going up at a certain speed, we would feel about this heavy. If we were just in outer space, we were going in a lift, we'd feel about this heavy as the lift was going. And that's sort of an analogy of how it is for gravity on Earth. It's like the way that space-time is altered around a planet. It's like we experience that like we're in a lift. But there isn't really any force of gravity, you know, pulling us. It's the actual fabric of space and time is in a way that I am unable to intuitively understand. Yeah, I like gravity because you can feel it, can't you? It's like it's a sort of a sense that somebody's pulling you. All right. Well, I think I have to be fair, you know. And Wes likes to lock up as well, and admit that we're not going to finish this lecture, and we haven't got to transcendentalism at all. And the whole second half of the lecture is missing. But for those of you listening to the tape, don't worry. Next week.